Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favour to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Morning, Jordan. Depends on where you are in the world, but I think it's a good afternoon. Good morning, is it?
Good morning. Based in Brisbane, so on the other side of the world. So yeah, it's morning. The morning after for me, yeah.
That's it. So Jordan, just a brief insight around who you are, what you do, dive into it, because I'm sure there's people that probably across your work before and maybe some others that haven't, so let's hear it, man.
Yeah, so first, thanks for having me, appreciate it a lot. I am currently a skill acquisition coaching researcher practitioner out here in Brisbane, so I'm working with a lot of different coaches across a range of different sports. I've just completed my master's and I will probably go on to a PhD later in the year. Prior to this, I've been doing this for the last couple of years. Prior to that, I did a little bit of PE teaching, and prior to that, I was mostly a strength and conditioning coach in rugby union, actually. But that's kind of where my interest in skill acquisition came from, looking at how we can kind of apply these skill acquisition principles to movement. So yeah, and prior to that, that was my first role. So I was based in Hong Kong for 5 years, and prior to that, I studied an undergrad in sports science. So that's a quick stop over the last probably 10 years or whatever. So yeah.
Awesome. And then is there really, you know, a few different questions that kind of coming off in my head, and obviously a large part of me doing the podcast and really getting involved in it was one, my own CPD, because I think there's great conversations to be had and there's so much information to kind of pick up on. But I think the beauty of conversations and podcasts in particular is that everyone offers a slightly different insight based on their own experiences. Obviously there's some consistent messaging across loads of different areas, obviously in your case skill acquisition being one of them, science being having a science background. But again, even in those spaces, right, there's going to be so many different perceptions and ideas, and I guess that's part of the interest and curiosity. That's why you got into your research space. So just let's start with that then. You know, talking about the skill acquisition, for those that maybe aren't familiar with what skill acquisition actually is and actually means, what is it from your perspective?
Yeah, so I suppose within skill acquisition there's a few different perspectives. I suppose my own perspective would be skill is the ability to adapt in the simplest form, like that's the shortest definition I could give. So skill is the ability to adapt. So how can we help our players become adaptable or become more skillful in that sense? So with that is it's very much like how can we present opportunities for our players or our athletes where they have to adapt to the constraints or the variability that we provide. So within that then there's a couple of different key points. One would be challenge points. So how challenging, how difficult do players find a task? If it's too easy, well then what I go back to a lot is the Goldilocks principle. So if it's too easy, they're not going to learn. If it's too hard, they're probably disengaged because, you know, they might be humiliated or they might just, you know, not see a path to development. So we want to, as much as possible, we want to try and make our task just right in terms of difficulty. And then I suppose another key principle would be the idea of fish tanking. So a fish tank is a representative sample of the ocean. So for fish in a fish tank, there's rocks, there's seaweed, there's potentially other fish, and crucially, there's water. So so if we were to apply that to our training task, some of the key elements of our training task should involve obviously player, obviously a ball, opponents, probably a direction of play and a consequence. So, and that's not a consequence, is not a physical punishment, but like a consequence, if I'm attacking and I lose the ball, then I'm defending and the other team might have an opportunity to score. So that's all coming from the task design model of Mark O'Sullivan. But I suppose the broader concept of fish tanking would be kind of representative learning design. In a nutshell, that's skill acquisition in my, so skill as the ability to adapt. So do you ever technically acquire skill? Maybe not. It's more continuous learning and growing and developing process between a player and the environment that they're within.
Yeah, and I think there's so many things in what you've said there already. It kind of just, again, sparks off different thoughts, right? And I think, you know, just really trying to pull out some key things in what you've said. First and foremost, I love the two analogies, Goldilocks principle, really, really key, you know, paints the picture in my mind around what we're going after. I think from a skill acquisition standpoint, even just in the way that you've defined it, it's, you know, the ability to adapt. It's really interesting because obviously if you ask a lot of coaches, especially when it comes to sport in terms of, and maybe differentiate technique and skill, there's a whole complete, you know, different debate on what that looks like and what that should be. And obviously, traditionally speaking, I'd say, especially through my experiences in coach education, well, if you look at the concept of skill, a lot of people just think it might be to start with maybe tricks and maneuvers that you might do. And often skill is very much linked to stuff that's happening in possession. I guess really what you're saying, and I guess the concept of skill acquisition is much more around the idea of actually how well can you program around you to execute on specific decisions, or rather how well can you perceive the variables that are, in this case, game representative variables that allow you to then process and then output a decision, not based on execution, but the ability to make the decision that would lead to potential execution of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think you've hit on a really, really important point. First thing, like in technique and skill, kind of, I don't want to call it a debate, but like that kind of trade-off. First thing I'd say is, my own opinion is technique and skill are both important. If we look at, say you were to take someone, say Haaland, all of Haaland's shots this season, they'd all be different because the environment is very different. So whether it's that with his head or with his left foot, with his right foot, or the angle he's at with the goal, the pressure he's under from defenders. So there's all these different constraints that are acting on him at any given time. So from that point of view, he needs to be skillful to be able to perceive all that information and appropriately regulate his actions. So that's looking at it from a skill perspective. But on the other side, the technique perspective is still reasonably important, because, you know, you don't kick the ball, like, you kick the ball in a reasonably similar way. So, like, if I'm kicking with my left foot, my right foot needs to stand somewhere close to the ball. So that's arguably a technical point. If I'm going to, you know, I might extend my right arm for balance or whatever it is. So these technical points are not completely redundant, but if we just focus on the technical points, then we're probably missing a large piece of the pie. Yeah. You know, so the issue is not whether it's one or the other, it's one and the other. So it's technique and skill, and part of a coach's decision making is understanding when to focus on one, when to focus on the other. And I suppose what I would say is, generally, and this has kind of come up with a lot of my research, generally there's probably been a bit too much focus on drills and isolated practice. And again, I go back to, like, that's not redundant. Like, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just how appropriate is its use. And I think coaches probably tend to spend a bit too much time on that lower end of the spectrum, the isolated stuff, when in fact their players are capable of much more. Their players are capable of, you know, executing that technique, if that's what the focus is, even under more pressure or under more challenging constraint. And that's going back to the Goldilocks principle. Often isolated practice is just too easy. So while coaches might think that there's learning going on, it's probably not, because players just aren't engaged enough. So that's kind of a wider point on the technique skill kind of trade-off that you have. So yeah.
No, I think it's a great point. And again, there's already a few thoughts coming into my head, and some previous ones that from what you said earlier. And I think let's start with that. You know, you use the phrase there, reasonably similar technique. And I think it's a really good way to put it, because fundamentally, it goes back to that piece around repetition without repetition, right? Two things are never, the two situations are never going to be exactly the same. And then, you know, I don't know if we can physically measure whether they were anyway. But in essence, if the situation is never going to be the same, what technique are we practicing, right? And I always throw the question out to coaches, like, well, again, similar to you, it's not that it's redundant. I agree that technique has a place, and of course it does, because it does. But the way I look at it is this, is, rather than teaching techniques in a way that's one size fits all in many cases for a lot of people, why don't we look at it and break it down as, what are the consistent variables within it? So what are the universal factors, i.e. you referenced there around striking a ball, having the non-kicking relatively close to the ball. But actually, relatively close to the ball is relatively close because it's subjected to the individual, right? Therefore, it can never be the same. But if we can accept and the idea of you that the non-kicking foot does have to be relatively close to, and more specifically the rationale behind it, which is have it specifically or relatively close to, so that we can have a specific element of balance, shall we say, then let's accept that that's what we're there for. And as long as the players have put themselves in a position where they've got that relative balance, then what's the issue, right? And I always give the example, like, your Pep Guardiola and Erling Haaland scores 50 goals at the end of the season, good return, right? But what if the analyst comes back to you and says, did you notice every single one of those goals was off his right kneecap? Still going to be upset? Are you still going to be happy about it? And then, yeah, well, still goals. Well, that's it then, isn't it? So look, why don't we start setting more objectives for players rather than describing a process for how they get there? they figure their own way out, then that's coming back to what you said. You know, they're becoming adaptable, skillfully yeah. adaptable to the situations that are put in front of them. Now, if he's figured out a way to score 50 goals off his right kneecap, then let him keep doing it. So, you know, that's one part of it. And I guess, you know, the other part of it is, well, when we're breaking it down, what I can go back to those universal factors. Well, what universal, the basic example is given is, well, look, if Jordan's facing me 10 yards in front of me, there's one thing that's fact that he has to do with the ball, get it to me. He has to strike through the back of it because I'm opposite him.
Yeah. Whereas
if he doesn't strike through the back of it, there's no chance it's going to go to me. Doesn't matter what part of the foot he uses, doesn't matter what part of the toes he uses, his heel, whatever he uses, he's not going to get to me because it's the direction he needs. Now, that bit is where we start getting a bit individualized and become a bit spoke in terms of what that technique and what that process looks like for the individual. So I guess for those that are maybe still battling with the idea, no, but surely we have to do technique first. What's your thoughts on that? And, you know, in the way I always put it is, going with technique is fine. Understand that the technique that you're potentially teaching the individual is a solution to a problem.
Yeah.
How much context are you giving to what the problem is, alongside delivering the emphasis, information around what that technique may or may not be?
Yeah, great one. So what the first thing I'd say is kind of touching on what you just said there. It's important to define a technique or technique. So for me, a technique is a movement solution that a player would apply in a particular behavior or problem. So if, say, for example, someone scores a goal and it's on camera, and then we look at it again and we analyze what he did and whatever else, he used a technique there. So we could say, oh, his technique is good. So we're looking at that particular problem, looking at that particular goal, his particular behavior solution for that particular problem was good. So his technique was good. So that's like, on the other hand, like if we were to look at it, say a highlights over a period of time, and then he's using different techniques for different kind of problems, then we would say he's skillful because he is able to find a technique to suit the problem. Skill, I try and remember this quote, I think it was Carol Newell. Skill is not the ability to repeat a solution, it's the ability to repeatedly find a solution to the given problem. So, and that's not an exact quote, but that's a gist of what it is. In terms of should technique come first, to an extent, yes, I do think technique should come first. But it is, I'm talking about like under four, under five, under six, under seven technique. To give you an example, like I do a bit of Gaelic football coaching out here in Brisbane, which is a bit rogue in itself. But I've been working with like under fours, under five groups, and I put it to them about what do they want to do. What games do they want to do? And, you know, they come up with stuff like, what time is it, Mr. Wolf or Duck Duck Goose and all that. And that's fine. That's because that's something that they're capable of doing. But no amount of Duck Duck Goose or what time is it, Mr. Wolf is going to help them develop the skills that they need. So develop the ability to kick the ball, or it is fun, and that's a key aspect to it. But that needs to be balanced. Like if we're looking to develop players in a specific sport, they need opportunities. And then it goes back to that Goldilocks principle. Isolated technique or isolated practice might be just right for players of such a low skill level, like 4 and 5 year olds. When we get to 12, 13, 14, 15, and then beyond, do I think such an emphasis needs to be placed on technique. And when we say technique as in isolated practice, absolutely not, because they already have the, like, in terms of challenge point, in terms of that Goldilocks principle. I mean, sometimes isolated practice in small doses might be useful, but personally, I don't think there's a need to spend so much time on that isolated practice, because that's just too easy for them. What's just right, and they need to develop their ability to perceive the information, to adapt their movement strategy. So they need to be put in situations where they're making that decision. They're always making that decision that you spoke about, as in, and that can be kind of simplified or complexified, or like made easier, made harder. Like a simple one is, if you start off with a 5-on-5, okay, so the attacking team might be finding it too difficult, so you might go 6-on-4. So then the attacking team have an extra 2 players, but all the time you're keeping the key information present within your training task, so you're developing the skill rather than just the technique.
No, it makes absolute sense, and I guess it takes me back to the concept of the 3 R's in terms of practice design, making realistic, relevant, repetition within it, right? And I look at it as picture a seesaw. Seesaw can only work if it's got a pivot in the middle. The pivot in the middle has to be the relevance. It doesn't matter whether you go down this end of the spectrum or that end of the spectrum. It's got to have relevance. And I take on board what you said, right? It's got to be engaging for the players. It's got to be fun for the players. But fun doesn't always necessarily mean engagement, and engagement doesn't always necessarily mean fun. But the relevance is key, right? And I think one thing that I remember speaking of, and I just talked about, if you don't have the realism in your practice, i.e. the variables and design piece, it's not to say that it doesn't have a place, but all you can actually, in my opinion, you can't teach whatever it is they're actually trying to do. You're just teaching an element of what you want to see, but understanding and accept that when you're going down that route, it's going to be out of context, therefore the transference of that is probably limited, if at all possible. Now, I would actually counter and say, my opinion, my experience, whether technique is actually needed as a focus in the first instance at a young age. Because if I, and I'm talking explicit technical anyway, if I put ball in ball at your feet, the 3 of you playing on a patch of grass somewhere, someone's coaching you how to do it, but you're going to have to work out your own way to play, right? And I think, I guess the hurdle for me sometimes, going back to this piece around technique as well, what is ideal technique? What does good technique actually look like? And a question that was coming into my mind as you were speaking before as well, is it good technique if the outcome wasn't achieved? I don't know. But there's many times where you'd see a player who, a player make a pass, maybe, the technique of that pass was great. Yeah, but he hit it 5 yards wide. Yeah, but his body and his movement pattern and the technique might have looked textbook, if you like. Yeah, but if he doesn't achieve it, then it's still a good technique. There's something else going on there. And I think it comes back to your piece around skill and being adaptable in terms of finding an appropriate technical solution on body, movement pattern, to kind of execute and get the outcome that you're looking for. Now, obviously, there's other variables that contest with that, i.e. person you may be passing the ball to, where the opposition are and whatever, but actually that's part of the process in terms of information you have to maybe, I guess, search through, sift through, filter through, then make a decision. But then making a decision and then executing on a decision are two completely different things in their own as well, right? There's so many other thoughts in my head right now, but let's start with that.
Yeah. So just going back to what you said there, is it good technique if the outcome the outcome was poor? Yeah, that's a great question. What I would say is I would possibly phrase the question a bit differently, because good will mean different things to different people. And whether that's coaches or players or even different players and different coaches, good is quite ambiguous. How I would rephrase that is functional. So is the technique functional, as in does it work? So and if the outcome isn't achieved, then the technique wasn't functional. You know what I mean? So that's how I would look at that one. I suppose in terms of what you said at the start, how much explicit coaching is needed. Personally, I'm with you. I don't think explicit coaching is needed really that much at all. I don't think it's the case where, I mean, I do. I think a player can develop without any coaching. So then that would lead to the question, how does a coach add value to a player's development? And then how is a coach adding value versus putting roadblocks in front? Because if a coach is interrupting a session every 5 minutes or every 2 or 3 minutes, as I've seen in the past, to give 30 seconds of instruction or to give really, really specific technical cues or technical instructions, that to me is putting a roadblock in front of the player's development. They are hindering the player's development. They are hindering the player's ability to, read information and make appropriate adjustments to their own skill. So then you're looking at how can a coach add value? Well, and again, I go back to the Goldilocks principle. It's about understanding what each player needs at any given time. You know what I mean?
I mean, the only thing that comes into my mind as you're speaking there, and I'm fully with you. However, I find in my own experience, isn't there a danger or a risk there where coaches sometimes now hiding behind players are going to work it out? Because I think, and I talk about this a lot, how I'm sure it is similar in other sports, but I think coach education has changed so much over the years. Where many sports, it is way of working. This ideology that of skill acquisition and individual creativity and all the other stuff that comes with it, right? My fear that so far down that end of the spectrum, that coach is almost underappreciate, undervalue how important technical framework to work from, to the point where even if there was some technical information that was required around specific techniques or whatnot, I'm not saying there's a one size fits all. The way I often phrase it is, you don't need to have the way, but you should have a way plays in developing that technique, whatever it is. It comes back to my earlier point of coming back to what some of the universal things that you can still go and attack, i.e. that, the example you gave about the non-kicking, you're not even addressing that and you're not even identifying that as a potential source of information, bit of information provided for a person. How are you adding value? And this is one of the other questions to you speaking earlier as well. Going down this route, skill acquisition, how does a coach add value in that? What is the behavior that couples itself with that approach?
Yeah, so touching on what you said before, so we talk about the spectrum of technique to skill. I mean, there's lots of different spectrums that coaches have to navigate, and it's never just one way or this way. Like, so if we go too far down the route of, you know, an athlete and their environment, and, you know, what you said, so players will, coaches hide behind, players will work it out. For me, that's just a coach absolving themselves of responsibility to actually support the development of their players. So in that kind of what I was touching on before was, coaches have to understand the individual and the contextual variability. So the same task for two different players can bring about very different emotional responses. So one player might be able to cope with, you know, he only succeeds 4 times out of 10, but he's still able to persevere through that mostly failing task to actually get a positive outcome. Whereas another player, he might need to succeed at least 7 times out of 10 to ensure that his engagement and his emotional energy doesn't drop. So in that situation, the coach has to understand how can he or she manipulate the task to suit the individual, the individual's kind of emotional regulation, or how they can regulate their emotions, or how their individual challenge point. So absolutely, just throwing a player into a game, like throwing them into the deep end, so to speak, and then just figure it out, like that's not coaching either. So one thing I always come back to, I remember I was at a track and field center called Altus in the United States, and Dan Papp, who's a legendary track and field coach, he said something really, really direct and really profound and about technical models. And he said, you've got to coach to something, because if you don't have a technical model to coach to, then how can you make decisions against anything? Like, so if someone executes a technique that could potentially be injurious, as in it could cause an injury because it's unsafe or whatever. Well, if a coach has no technical model to lean against or to reflect against in terms of evaluating that technique, are they going to encourage the player to change it and potentially reduce their risk of injury? So absolutely, I'm kind of all on board what you're saying. It's not all, you know, figure it out yourself, and it's not all technical execution. Both of them are very valid strategies, and it's the ability of a coach to move across that spectrum dependent on who they have in front of them, and dependent on like a wide range of factors. So how close the next competition is, how important the next game is in terms of, you know, if they win this game, do they qualify for another tournament, which gives them another 6 weeks of prep time, so then they can be more exploratory in that sense. So it's, yeah, I'm fully agreeing with you in terms of, you know, it's not just one side, throw them into the deep end. It's not just the other side of, you know, they have to be very technically focused. It's being able to switch between the two.
Really what you're saying is about developing an understanding of your players, your participants, right? And I think this is a phrase that I use quite a lot. I'm looking at the game and observing the game with our eyes, but through their experience, get better at looking out of the situation, at the situation. And if you're looking out from the situation, perfect example that you gave, there two scenarios that they look the same, but actually the perception of them is very different for the individuals involved. One, because of their skill level; two, because of how they perceive the opposition and the pressure that it then develops for them, right? And but I really like the idea of, you know, you're talking about how it makes them feel as well, because the feeling is really key. I often play with this idea, and if we, as coaches, actually got the players becoming more attuned to how the situations are actually making them feel rather than they're seeing. Because if they can get better attuned to that, and they can feel the situation better, they can also feel the, I guess, the biomechanical movements and the body, the movement, as you referred to them earlier, then surely that's information they can use to better become better at being skillful and adaptable at the moment, right? But there's a lot of detail in there. There's a real depth in there, right, that you've got to kind of get through. And I think then makes me think around what are your thoughts then on coaches and who aren't able to play the sport. I've got limited experience playing this sport. I really have true empathy for that kind of that movement pattern or that situation and that perception of things within those moments. And then I guess couple that to the previous question around does coaching behaviors look like with this type of approach, because it makes me think about my own coaching philosophy and very much I've always said I don't really have a playing philosophy. The game is based on principles. Let's focus on the principles. Stick to that. So the playing philosophy don't actually mean anything. And is this, if you give me space to go in behind, I'm behind. Oh. And if you don't give me space in behind, I'm going to look to play through or around. Just how the game works, right? But coaching philosophy, on the other hand, very clear on what that looks like. It kind of, for me, I've got three kind of guiding principles for me. I kind of fall back on one is obviously incentive design, making sure that the variables are there so your fish analogy comes in. And then two, a large part of it within my coaching behaviors is around, I refer to a skillful and articulate Q&A. It's how do you get the players to become better aware of, one, what the variables are that they have to consider, two, their perception, their understanding of how those variables then influence their ability to perform and execute decisions, and three, show and tell for me is, regardless of what your coaching or what your focus is, has to be visual representation of something, whether that's you walking them through it, whether that's them on a tactics board, or whether that's them showing you on a micro space of what the expectation is. But that checking of understanding, and within that comes the idea that they don't have to take it on as you've laid it down, but actually what they've taken on, have they understood enough about it and the what you're going after well enough to still get from A to B, even if it's not the direct path that you've set down for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's loads in that, which is great, and we're trying to unpack it, or definitely give my kind of perspective as I go through. So the first thing, like you spoke about, was, is a player aware of how they feel? So we were talking about how does the training task make a player feel? And we had some coaches over from New Zealand. So my current context is a lot of my work is done in rugby union. And so I'm working with coaches who, as part of a rugby club. And we had coaches over from New Zealand. They ran a sample session. And at the end of their task, they asked players three questions. What did you see? So that's what information are they perceiving? What did you hear? So that can be communication from their teammates or what the opposition are saying to each other or what the referee is saying. And then the last one is, what did you, how did you feel? So those three questions, that are a really powerful framework for coaches to use with players, especially developing players, young players, to develop their ability to, and I've written down, to detect errors, and then when they start detecting their errors, then they can start correcting their errors. So in terms of In terms of a broader kind of practice design kind of framework or principle, what are coaches looking to? One thing coaches may be looking to do is to provide a safe space for players to explore and ultimately fail. So the first thing that they need is psychological safety to make errors. Now, psychological safety can look different in different environments, but if a player knows that he can try something, he or she can try something, and they're not going to be shamed or bullied or mocked or anything like that, and they're actually going to be praised for their effort, well, then they'll have psychological safety to actually explore and make errors. Once they have the psychological safety to make errors, then they need to be able to detect errors, which kind of what we spoke about, what you see, what you hear, what you feel, and that can inform their ability to detect errors. And then over time, then you want them to develop their ability to correct errors. Now, the last thing I'd say is, like, in terms of guiding attention. So essentially, my work with coaches now is to stimulate reflective practice. And we spoke a bit about this offline, but stimulate reflective practice. And a big part of my role is to guide the attention of coaches to stuff that they may not have considered. And in some ways, I feel like my role, a skill acquisition specialist to a coach, is very similar to a coach and an athlete. So oftentimes an athlete or a coach is trying to guide the attention of an athlete to different aspects, to different information sources that they may not have considered. And then they're able to consider that and then utilize that in their decision-making process when they decide to execute a specific action in a given situation. So, so that's kind of the full circle, coach, athlete, coach, developer, coach, and how there's similarities in kind of the full process. If that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's just building on that then. So effective practice is obviously really key. Talk about it a little bit offline. And I think I want to debunk this idea that a lot of coaches have, especially more that about making the players fall in the game. That's all it's about, which I'm fully on board with. By the way, I'm not absolute, critic of that. I think it's
really important
to get them to fall in love with the game, but I do want to debunk the myth that you can't have that alongside development, and I think they go hand in hand. And if in actual fact, I often think actually, well, if someone is developing at something, they're probably going to end up enjoying it anyway. Whereas if it was just about fun, why don't I just take my kids down to play on the local trampolines and I have fun doing that? I'll keep them engaged and they'll fall in love with that. But actually, no, the development and fundamentally, what's the coach? And in my opinion, the role of the players are the participants in developing whatever they're there for. Engagement, fun piece is just a kind of, that's the door expression.
Yeah.
Right? You have to go through it. You have to have that. Otherwise, they're not going to develop in the first instance. But the challenge I put on coaches, what happens if they're already enjoying it? Now what?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Great point. I was at a coaching workshop or seminar yesterday, and there was talk of long-term athlete development and then short-term athlete development. So long-term athlete development is your pathway, your kind of ages and stages type stuff. Learning to play, learning to train, or whatever model you want to use. And then the short-term athlete development is more what happens in a given session. And it's not that long-term athlete development is bad, or that short-term athlete development is just short-sighted. It's about understanding, and this is a common theme that we spoke about, understanding how to kind of manipulate or gauge your focus of each at the appropriate time. So like you said, fun is the kind of the opening of the door. But big thing for coaches is we want to promote development and promote learning in our players. Now, two things about learning. Learning is effortful, so it's hard work sometimes. So learning is effortful, and then second thing, learning is not inherently enjoyable. You can look back on the times that you learned and think, oh yeah, I enjoyed that. But when you're in a learning environment at the time, you're not necessarily enjoying yourself. So in that situation,
no, but can I just pause you for really quickly? And that's a really, really good point. That's what you call challenge, though.
Yeah, exactly. So again, going back to the Goldilocks principle, what is the challenge that is just right for them? That it may not be enjoyable in the moment, but it's something that they can stick with. It's not insufferable, or it's not insurmountable, the pain that they're going through, the challenge that they're going through, but it is enough for them to learn and then to develop and get better. And then as they get better, their challenge needs to increase as well. So like, I think you make a really good point around, you know, it's not all about fun. Fun is a critical piece, and I'm not saying it should not be fun, or it should not be fun. I'm not saying that it should, like, fun is a critical piece, but it's not all about fun, in the same way that learning is a critical piece, but at the same time.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Creating a learning environment may not be suitable for 100% of the time. It's this part of the coach's decision making.
You know, I get where you're coming from, but I would challenge it. I'd say I think creating a learning environment is suitable for all the time, but it's recognizing that learning isn't always in a forward direction, and you can't measure learning until you see it happen. Does that make sense? Like, learning environment, yeah. I think should be constant, but actually sometimes recognize that the performance of the individuals in any given moment might actually look like it's regressed. That's fine.
Yeah, I'm not sure on that point, actually. I think learning is non-linear. So, like, yeah, like, so what you're saying is you might have to get worse to get better. Or that's how it might look. So I agree on that point. I suppose, say we took a session plan, and for the first 5 minutes, we were just going to do a fun warm up, which was something like a personal favorite of mine is capture the flag. That's a fun warm up, but for football players, especially 12, 13, 14, and if you're at a decent level, there's no football involved. Now, you could probably adapt it to include a football, but there's no football involved in the traditional aspect of the game. So that's not really set up for learning to support their learning in a football context. There is agility and like one-on-one task, and they have to escape and all that. But for learning context, for learning kind of learning in a football context, it's not really set up. Now, that's okay because it's not a huge chunk of your session. Like so, and the aim is to really develop core body temperature and whatever else. So I suppose I'm just trying to think out loud in terms of should your environment be a learning environment 100% of the time?
I guess if you look at that as an example, right? Captured of like, I think there still can be learning. I think you could teach the principles of play there. Right, so I think even if it's not technical on the ball stuff, actually there's some key principles that will be brought out through that. I mean, maybe that's just me being greedy in terms of the outcomes that I'm going after. Right, I'm always thinking, right, how do I become more deliberate and intentional? How do I become deliberate practices, intentions of what I get out of the session, and how can I make it more engaging, more relevant, and more useful? Players at every given sometimes people might I can appreciate and accept the argument that says that too much too often, maybe isn't. I don't know, I just think to myself, I want to become as efficient as possible in the time that I have, because I guess that's another key piece, right? Is how much time do you have with your players? I'm working in an academy, maybe I've got 3 sessions a week, game days, which have some influence and have some impact on the players, in which case I might be a bit more choosy about I split that time up. But if I'm a grassroots coach, maybe one session a week, in some cases I probably allotted 60 minutes, but I'm probably going to get 60 minutes out of the session anyway. Probably want to get more bang for my buck, if you like.
Yeah, like I suppose just as you're speaking there, and I'm kind of I'm almost reflecting in my own head, like against different kind of things. Like I absolutely agree, like in terms of if you have 60 minutes, you should have a specific intention for your session, and then all activities, including the warm-up, and if you do a cool down, including those kind of trivial activities, should be aligned to your session intention, your learning intention of the session. So I absolutely agree on that. In terms of, I suppose what I was thinking of, like, if you focus on the, say the 60 minutes of your session, and you as a coach, you might decide whenever you're training, whenever you cross the white line, whenever your team cross the white line and they train, it has to be geared towards learning. And as we said, learning is not necessarily enjoyable, and it's effortful. It's hard work. But then, as a coach, you try and make sure whenever you're not across the white line, so whether that's you know, in having discussions with players beforehand, or, you know, or traveling to games or whatever it is, whenever you're not in kind of training mode, that's when you're going to place an emphasis on fun, on the fun aspect. So then, I suppose I'm arguing with myself here at the moment, but like, in terms of should training be always learning based, possibly, and then you might look at the fun aspects outside of training, or should it be a combination of both in between? And I suppose that really depends on, as you said, who you have in front of you, what are the external influences. So like, what are the parents saying? What's the culture of the club? What is the playing level? Like, is it Premier Division, or is it, say, Division 4 or whatever else, where the focus might be a bit more on participation? So that's a big thing. Like, what is the ultimate focus of the group? Is it, and this is another spectrum, participation to performance? And it's not all always, like, even on the participation end of the spectrum, you still, like, players will still want to perform as best as they can. So yeah, I kind of said nothing there, but just that's what the...
It's good. I guess it's good sometimes to have those conversations, right? Because the thing is, it's making you think, right, well, actually, what do I believe in? I guess building on that then, linking it back into some of the work that you do, let's talk about this reflective practice piece. Like, a lot of coaches, but you know, what their reflection is, it's just usually on the car on the way home, or a few little thoughts, because, you know, probably doesn't even get jotted down anywhere, probably just a mental note. You know, they come back to the next session a couple of days later, or even if they're lucky enough to get in that soon, and they've probably forgotten what they thought about anyway. But let's start with that. You know, obviously, big piece of reflections. What are some of the key things that you think really start to nail down in terms of... me personally, I'm always going down the route of try and make it as tangible as possible. Know what worked well, but understand why it worked well. Know what you've done differently and understand why. What are you trying to achieve? Like, be deliberate and intentional to the point where even when you're receivers and your plans and your approach to delivery of a session, understanding the types of interactions you're going to have, intentional, reflecting what those interactions are, who you're going to have them with, and what are the types of questions you're even going to ask your players based on the outcomes that you set for the session ahead. You know, where does your mind go with all this stuff?
Great question. And I think reflective practice can be really powerful. First thing I'd say is, two things I'd say. Like, I'm not necessarily an expert, but I've just tried my best over the last few months and years, really, to try and nail down what I'm saying or what I'm thinking about. And then the other thing is, reflective practice is complex. So what works for me may not work for you. What works for you may not work for some of your listeners. It may work for some of your listeners. So, like, that's one thing I would kind of keep in mind. Huh?
Bit of a disclaimer, yeah?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I suppose broadly, the first two things that I would think about is what is reflective practice? And I just have a definition here where it's using processes to examine performance and increase personal awareness to enhance future growth and development. So as a coach, you do one session, you reflect on it, and hopefully that creates opportunities for the next session to be better. And then it might be 0.01% better than the previous session, but if you accumulate that over a long period of time, hopefully you're 10% better after a season, and then season on season you're 40% better, or whatever it is, say over a 4-year period. But so that's what reflective practice is. To inform that, what are coaches? Do coaches understand what to reflect on? and new coaches have a body of knowledge to reflect against. So if I look at something, so some to give a personal anecdote from the last couple of years, my research, a big component of my research has been on activity time of player activity time within a session. And so I've been giving back ratios. Some of it have been players are active for 90% of the session, inactive for 10%, which is pretty good. Sometimes players have been active for 50% and inactive for 50%, and that's maybe not as good. But
what's optimal in your mind? How do you assess whether it's what's optimal in your mind and how do you assess what it is?
Yeah. So, well, we can get into that now if you want. Like, in terms of activity time, say, like, you've all these different bodies of knowledge. So, say your focus is on learning, and then you want players to learn as much in the game as possible. Then you're obviously going to try and promote activity time, and specifically activity time within a game-based environment. But what about when inactivity might support other learning strategies? Like, it might support me looking at you, so I'm observing you, so that's observational learning. Or it might provide the opportunity for me to think about my practice and reflect. Or it might provide the opportunity, if we take into account a strength and conditioning perspective, inactivity might allow me to rest and recover so I can perform again at a high intensity. So there's all these different, and like they're all saying something slightly different, and no one is necessarily wrong, but it's not right to say that any one particular way is the way. So that's where a coach has to kind of, what is the optimal activity inactivity ratio? It, for me, it doesn't exist. It completely
it's
depends.
Contextual, right? I mean, because one of the
absolutely
the reason why I asked the question is look, I'm very much, like I said, I like the sessions to be very much player centered, and often is a conception, a misunderstanding of what player centered actually is, and it's not the same as being player led. And because it's player centered, a lot of my observations, a lot of my coach behaviors are very much in the idea that I wanted to focus around what I'm seeing the players and what the players need. Now, one of the common observations and bits of feedback, and I really take it as a observation more than else, is yes, you spend a lot of time having conversations with your players, much activity taking place. And often I respond with some version of, well, come and see me in 8 weeks time with the same group of players, because yes, in essence, what I'm a firm believer of the idea, well, let me front load them.
Okay.
But not necessarily information, considerations. Right. Let me front load them, get them thinking about some of the variables they have to observe and be aware of. Because I can get them thinking about these things from minute one, for lack of a better way of describing it, but early on in particular, then a lot of my interactions building on from that would be in 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks down the line, very much signposting back to earlier conversations and discussion, in which case by that point there is a lot more activity time, because I guess I front loaded them with the conversations at the start of the process, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. And that's a strategy that you have found has worked for you, and crucially it has supported your players' development. What I would say back to that is, what if the front loading of considerations or of information was created a challenge that was too difficult for players. And then because it was too difficult, they weren't able to engage at the right level. So I it's worked for you and for the players that you've had, and I wouldn't question that. I suppose what I'm saying is, as you said at the start of what you just said, it's contextual. So taking into consideration the individuals you have or the individuals that you're working with, and then getting the challenge just right. So it might be that you hold back some of the considerations that you're gonna.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I'd go back to the similar first that I had earlier around technique. Well, they are considerations, but some of them are going to be that all everyone has to consider. So I'll start with those. Something everyone has to consider. How do we get more get into fine detail, get into more depth, breadth from that? Who are the teammates? Who are the? Then it starts taking my mind to the idea of, well, a lot of scenario based type work. And let's imagine that this is playing against a team who love to defend crosses. But we still very much want to box. Does that mean for how we're going to do it? Team that we'd like to play against, they might say, well, attacking in the air. Okay, where's the opportunity? Where's the square? You know, effectively have that conversation. I find myself having that conversation by way of almost a SWOT analysis, right? Strengths, what are the weaknesses, what are the opportunities, what are the threats? And then kind of going through it with that. Maybe I've just been fortunate in many respects that haven't quite found a time that I can think of where that has been too much of a challenge for the players to unpack, because again, it's a framework, but fundamentally it's guided by their perception. And by having a framework, it's just understanding, really it's just a framework for me to utilize to assess their understanding, their perception, rather than an assessment for an outcome. I'm not looking for a right or wrong answer, but I'm your answer.
Yeah.
And then throw in some considerations into the mix. So I think the depth of the answers they come back with will often guide it and shape how much more consideration I give them.
Yeah.
From that perspective, very much contextual, yes. I think from a base level, it's, I guess, the thought that's coming in my mind as I'm thinking about it now is, would I be doing you an injustice if I didn't shape your thoughts around universal considerations anyway?
Yeah, potentially. I think we're actually agreeing what you're saying. Like, so my question to you, and it's kind of a rhetorical one, of all the groups that you've utilized this framework in with, has your conversation been exactly the same each time?
No, I don't think it can be anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I agree. So like from that perspective, you're automatically adapting your delivery to the contextual. So like I think we're actually saying the same thing here. In terms of the contextual is pretty important.
But I think that's just on the, I guess, the development of the conversation rather than the foundations of it. Does that make sense? Because I would probably still, again, my language might be slightly different, but I'd probably still be having that same conversation whether you were 5, whether you were 25.
And I
know that can sound a bit extreme, but I'm saying that from experience of having done it with 4 or 5-year-olds and still getting them to think about it on a very basic level around, okay, what effectively, you know, the way I look at it is this. I work towards developing an environment where players are better at identifying the problem rather than solving the problem, because I believe if you have enough understanding of the problem, the solutions will present themselves for you.
Yeah, so that kind of feeds into what I said earlier about the ability to detect errors and the ability to correct errors. Another way of framing that would be, in order to get the best answer, you need to ask the best question. Or another way would be, you need to set the problem before you can solve the problem. And the better you set the problem, so the better you understand the issues or detect the errors that need correcting, the better you can do that, the more precise and concise you can be with your problem solving. So like, I agree with everything you're saying, really. I do think the contextual, like, that should be at the forefront of a coach's mind, rather than necessarily having a set way. I don't know, to be honest. Yeah, but you provoked a lot of thought. It's good.
Well, I'm just thinking about it now. I guess the thought that's coming in my mind at the moment is, well, as a coach, in order to, I guess, embark on that conversation, there needs to be a deep enough knowledge of the sport, of the game, right? And again, it goes back to my previous thought. Are we not at risk or in danger of people trying this way of working without having enough understanding of the game and almost hiding behind, the players will figure it out? Yeah, the players will figure it out. And the example I always give is, well, if I give a player the opportunity to play every week for the next 2 years, I can guarantee you they're going to get better than where they were when they started those 2 years. The question I've got for coaches thing is, well, how much of that was to do with you, though?
Yeah, so if I go back to what I said, and there's a lot of parallels between player development, athlete development, and coach development. But if I go back to what I said earlier, I said players can develop in the absence of a coach. They can. Just like coaches can develop in the absence of any, so for a coach, they start coaching their son's team at under six, and they end up following them all the way into under 17 or whatever. So they've got 10 or 11 years of coaching experience. But experience does not necessarily mean that they're going to be an expert coach. Experience is not equal expertise. And I think the same is true of athlete development. Just playing the game does not mean that they're going to be a good player. I suppose a key thing would be that reflective practice, and it does look slightly different for athletes and coaches, but as a coach, how are you promoting that reflective practice? And that could be reflective practice where, you know, it's conversations, or reflective practice in that players have to reflect in action on the game. So they're struggling at a task, and they're failing quite a lot, so they need to adapt something. Now, in terms of the body of knowledge that you spoke about, so that would be the second key question on reflective practice. Do coaches know what to reflect on? One, do coaches have an appropriate body of knowledge to reflect against? Because It's all good and well saying, oh, if I'm working with a coach, can you just consider your activity time, or like if we go back to that example, just consider your activity inactivity ratio. But the only experience or the only knowledge that coach has of what's appropriate is his past coaches. And they've always started off with the first 20 minutes very drill based, a lot of inactivity time. Then they go into something a bit more realistic to the game, and then they finish with a game for the last 20 minutes. And that's all he's experienced. So that's the knowledge that he has to reflect against. When knowledge, other knowledge, kind of what I spoke about in terms of learning, in terms of strength and conditioning, etc. That's all, they're all different bodies of knowledge that I can reflect against when I look at a coach's activity to inactivity time. Now, if a coach has a limited body of knowledge to reflect against, then the quality of their reflections is not going to be too deep, because they just don't know. And in a lot of instances, that's where I'm supporting them. So I'm supporting them with, by offering, much like this conversation has gone about, it's just offering different perspectives, which then promote thought to reflect against. And then it might lead to change behavior, it might not. And that's a lot of my work in terms of supporting that reflective practice. Do coaches have, because if coaches don't have the body of knowledge to reflect against, then whose fault is, like, and you ask them a question to reflect against, and is it a poor reflection based on my body of knowledge, which might be a bit more significant than what they have, or is it a good reflection given their body of knowledge that they possess? Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Obviously, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? So you can only reflect.
Correct, exactly.
I guess on that then, where would be a good place to start for coaches who don't necessarily have a soundboard, but not too sure how much of a body of knowledge they've really got around the area that they're looking at? What would be some good questions for you, in your perspective to start with on reflecting on that piece? Because I think there's, again, I'm very curious by nature.
Yeah.
I ask myself a lot of questions all the time, and I sometimes never get myself any answers, but I'm asking the questions nonetheless. And I think that process in itself of just asking the question is a good way to just get me ticking. Now, obviously, like you said earlier, everyone's going to be different. But I think questions are powerful. And I go back to the phrase that you used earlier, you know, the power of, you know, the quality of your answer is going to be determined by the quality of your question, essentially.
Yeah. Right?
So what are some good questions from your perspective that coaches can begin to start with if they're not already doing so? Or it might even be that the question that you provide is maybe a better alternative than the ones they're currently asking.
Yeah, so I think broadly, I think coaching is, I might have mentioned this already, coaching is a decision-making process. So you're constantly making decisions based on all the information. So because it's a decision-making process, whatever decision you make, you must have rejected alternatives. So then, I suppose if we were to take a session and take the plan, do, review process. So you write your session plan, you have a specific intention, and you've selected four or five or six activities that you're going to do to achieve your session intention. You go out and you do it, and then you review afterwards. So I suppose a process that coaches could follow within that, like, this could happen after every session. What was the aim? So what was the learning intention? And that should be checked off by your session plan anyway. What did you do? So in terms of the implementation, were there any deviations from the plan that you had set? And if there were, why? And that might be, they might be forced, or we had two players injured and we didn't have enough numbers, or like you might have seen something that, okay, players weren't responding in the way that they wanted, whatever it might be. So how did players respond to this session plan, or to the session that you implemented? What else could you have done? So what other ways could you have achieved the same thing? So if you did a drill, could you have done that in it through a game? And that's a very broad one. Or if you did a 4-on-4, could you have done that in a 6-on-6? Or could you have done that in a 7-on-5? So what different ways, what other ways could you have achieved the same thing? And then how does this inform your next session? So I mean those are five questions that you could start with. I suppose another broad one, and this kind of linked back into the curiosity that you spoke about. What are the assumptions, or what learning assumptions have you made by designing your session like this? And that could go in 100 different ways. And, you know, but even if that was to spark a thought, and then, like, I mean, podcasts like this is a great podcast. There's loads of other podcasts, there's videos on YouTube, there's different blogs and whatever else online, and there's research articles. So we're in the information age, but we're also in the misinformation age. So people have to be curious and to be critical about what they read and who they listen to and whatever else, because some of it might be applicable to them, some of it may not be. So so just trying to spark that curiosity. What assumptions have you made by designing your session like this, or by setting up your environment like you have?
Yeah, it's just got me thinking out loud, and again, curiosity. Reflect on my own experience, and as you're speaking, I think, what do I do? What do I ask? What do I do? I always go back to some sort of scenarios. I love throwing scenarios at coaches. Scenario I'm coming up with in my head right now is, if you were asked to provide some information and some evidence why your methods are working, what would you provide for them? Right. I find that it really gets coaches thinking, actually, how do I know what I'm doing? And it can't be based on your opinion, but how can you get as close to objective as possible? Right, because it's not, oh well, I've seen Jordan in the last game was only making 5 forward passes, but this time he made 18. Yeah, but this time the opposition sat back.
Yeah.
Right, it can't be based on an opinion. What can you give us as close to a fact as possible to support your view, what you're seeing? As it being the reality, you know, and not just a fictional piece of what you've been built. I think that piece is really key. And the other one is, yeah, effectively, yeah, that's probably the best one. The one I've started using a lot now is prove that what you're doing is working.
Yeah. So, a couple of things, and it's along the same lines. How do you know players have developed because of what you've done, or in spite of what you've done? How do you know? And if I'm being honest, there is no answer to that question, but that would hopefully stimulate thought. And then secondly, and this is why I think it's really important to support coaches through their reflective practice. If a coach decides to go down the rabbit hole of trying to answer that question, it can, and it's happened to me, like it happens to me quite regularly. Like, how do I know what I'm doing is working? And I suppose my context would be slightly different. I'm working with coaches, but it can send you into an existential crisis. Like it can be quite intimidating. Absolutely, definitely. Like, but as long as you can pull yourself out and still make and still coach with the same enthusiasm and intensity and all that. So it's a balance, absolutely. Like I'm all for, and that's why this conversation has been good. Like I kind of stumbled on my thoughts a couple of times here, and I've been thinking about, well, okay, maybe is that true? And like, I'm trying to think through my own thought process. But like, that can be quite intimidating for coaches if they've never done it before. And that's why I think it's really important to support coaches through. The other thing I would say, and this is kind of in line with the question around what other way could you have done it? Now, potentially a young coach, a novice coach, they mightn't be able to articulate many different ways of doing something. So they might just decide this is the way of doing it because that's the only way I've seen, or that's the only way I know. So in that case, in a case like that, speaking to other coaches or buddying up with other coaches, so it might be an under 14 with an under 17 coach, or even a young coach with a coach of young kids, so like under 6 with under 14, just to get that complete different experience, or a coach from one club with a coach from another club, because now that would probably have to be done personally rather than through, maybe the clubs would agree, but like, just having the different perspectives can support that consideration of alternatives, and then it will support that, it will kind of build that body of knowledge, experiential knowledge, absolutely, of how coaches can go about their practice.
100%. It makes me think back about, you know, when I first started getting into academy football about 10 years ago, and one of the things I often used to do is I used to try and delve in, getting, you know, hands-on observational experience in other environments. And more specifically, I'll try and go to some of the bigger academies or the established ones surf, and I always ask myself, the question is, what are they trying to achieve and how are they trying to achieve it? And those two questions were so powerful at the time, because what I then followed it up with is, well, in the environment that I work in, how can I try and achieve that? What can't I do to achieve it? Meaning, they're going to have resources that I don't have. But if I know what they're trying to go after, and more specifically understand why they're trying to go after certain things, one, I get to decide whether that's right for me in my environment, in my context. And two, if it is something I'm going after, it's challenging. It's like, well, it did challenge me in many different ways. Figure out, well, what other ways can I try and achieve what they're trying to achieve it without having those resources and those facilities available to me. So those are really powerful for me. So I guess now I'm conscious of time as well, Jordan. Now, you know, I want to say a massive thank you for your time already, and it's been really appreciative. And again, you're giving me a lot of food for thought as well. And I guess the question I've got, just to kind of wrap up on then, you know, if there were some key takeaways from this conversation as a whole that you think, you know what, without having this conversation, coming into it as a, you know, if you were to refer this conversation to someone else and say, you know what, you've got to go and listen to this because this is going to get you thinking, well, what are key things that you think are going to get people thinking and they maybe need to go away and think about and apply here?
Yeah, so before I get to that, like, it just the last point I would make on reflection, like, so there's one thing, and you touched on it there. One thing is to critically reflect on your practice, and maybe one way that coach can learn is to go and observe other people. But then the other aspect is the critical application of new knowledge. So say you go and watch another coach and he does four things that you've never seen before, and you go and just apply them blindly. Like, that's poor practice, because unless you've got an understanding of what you said, what he's doing, why he's doing it, he or she, and that aligned with what you're trying to do in your own context, unless you've actually matched them up, then it's just copy and paste almost never works. In terms of trying to sell this conversation, I suppose what what it's done is, for me anyway personally, and maybe for you as well, like we've challenged each other around things. Like I definitely thought more because of this conversation, and hopefully anyone listening, it will stimulate them to think, and then them to consider. And like in terms of the reflective practice, hopefully it just stimulates them to ask questions of themselves and maybe each other if they're part of a coaching group, just to ask questions of each other and try and nail down, okay, well, what are the assumptions that I've made? Like, what are, like, is this the right way, or is this just the way that I've always done it? Or is this the right way, or is this just the way that I've seen someone else do it, and I really value their practice and their opinion? Like, and what assumptions have they made about it? Like, what do we actually know? And again, you know, we talk about the existential crisis, as in, it can be a good place to be, but like trying to better understand what you're doing, why you're doing it. I suppose, yeah, that'd be a key thing.
Just on that, I'm really curious, because you said it's made you think. What's made you think most?
I suppose the aspect of so without getting into direct or indirect perception, but like, what is the value of a coach? What is the role of a coach? If a player can develop, and I do believe a player can develop in the absence of any coach, but I also don't believe that coaches are unnecessary. I think coaches are really a really important part of the majority of player development. So how can we ensure that a coach is adding value to a player development rather than taking away from a player development? And then the other aspect of fun learning, in terms of, I don't think training should necessarily always be fun, and I don't think it can be fun, but should training always be geared towards learning? And then you're getting into, like, I'm stimulating more thought here in terms of performance be learning. At what point do we want to ensure players are performing well versus learning well? Which, I mean, that could be another 20-minute conversation there. But, those are the two main things. But, like, what is the role of a coach? How does a coach know that they are adding value versus presenting roadblocks?
Jordan, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been really insightful conversation, thought-provoking nonetheless as well. If listeners wanted to get in touch with you, is there any way they can do that?
So Twitter is jcassidy_sport, and I'm fairly active on Twitter, so I'll probably respond to your messages. My LinkedIn is Jordan Cassidy. I'm not as active on that, but I will probably respond eventually to if you send me a message there. And then I have my own website where I kind of write a lot about this kind of stuff. www.skilledathleticism.com, and then you can contact me through there, I think, as well. And yeah, so I need all channels.
Amazing. Jordan, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.